When Maria Sharapova failed a routine drug test at the 2016 Australian Open, her world collapsed overnight. The substance, meldonium, which she'd known as Mildronate, had been legal during her entire decade of using it for health reasons. The tennis world was stunned. How could one of the sport's most meticulous professionals make such a devastating oversight? As sponsors fled and critics pounced, Sharapova faced a potential 4-year ban that threatened to end her storied career. Yet those who knew her weren't surprised by what came next: absolute refusal to surrender. This resilience wasn't new. It had defined her since age 4, when she first picked up a racket in Sochi, Russia. "Knock me down 10 times," she writes, "I get up the 11th." Her autobiography reveals the extraordinary journey behind this iron will, from a childhood shaped by the Chernobyl disaster to becoming one of only 10 women to achieve a career Grand Slam. Beloved by fans for her fierce competitiveness and embraced by brands for her marketable elegance, Sharapova's story transcends tennis. It's about a father's unwavering belief, immigrant determination, and the making of a champion who refused to be defined by anyone else's expectations. My story begins in the shadow of catastrophe. When my pregnant mother was gardening in Gomo, Belarus, she heard a distant rumble, the Chernobyl nuclear disaster erupting just 40 miles away. Despite government assurances that everything was fine, panic spread as families fled. My parents escaped to Siberia, where I was born in 1987, before eventually settling in Sochi when I was 2. Our tiny apartment on Cherry Street became the launching pad for an improbable dream. At just 4 years old, I picked up a tennis racket at Riviera Park and showed unusual concentration, hitting against a wall for hours. This caught the attention of coach Yuri Yudkin, who recognized something special in me. Not raw talent, but extraordinary focus. While other children my age could barely concentrate for minutes, I would practice for hours without distraction. My gift wasn't strength or speed, but stamina and determination. I played with a cut-down racket that once belonged to Yevgeny Kafelnikov, developing basic strokes and concentration under Yudkin's guidance. In 1993, he delivered the assessment that would change everything, telling my father I was like Mozart, but needed to leave Russia to develop my talent. My father immediately dedicated his life to this vision, quitting his job to become my full-time coach and strategic advisor. Every morning before dawn, we would head to the grimy courts of Riviera Park. While other children slept, I practiced relentlessly. My mother, though skeptical of this all-consuming pursuit, trusted my father's judgment. This dynamic shaped my early development. My father focused entirely on competition and sports, while my mother emphasized education and literature. Between hitting sessions, I devoured books like Pippi Longstocking and spent precious time with my grandmother Tamara. The turning point came when Yudkin told us about a Moscow tennis clinic showcasing young Russian talent. Despite financial hardships, my father got us there. Among hundreds of children, each with parents convinced of their exceptional talent, I quickly realized I stood out. During one of my brief turns to hit, Martina Navratilova noticed me, a gangly kid with knees that knocked together and an oversized racket. Despite my awkward appearance, she saw something in how I struck the ball. After watching me, Navratilova pulled my father aside and, through a translator, delivered advice that would alter our trajectory forever. My talent needed development in America. Have you ever wondered what drives someone to risk everything on a seemingly impossible dream? What makes a parent uproot their entire life based on a stranger's assessment of their child's potential? These questions lie at the heart of my journey, one that would soon take us across the world with nothing but faith and determination. The early 1990s were a chaotic time in Russia as the Soviet Union collapsed. Leaving the country was nearly impossible, yet somehow my father secured rare 3-year visas for just the two of us, meaning my mother would stay behind. With barely $700 to our name, we boarded a flight to Miami, stepping into the unknown with nothing but determination and a tennis racket. Our American dream quickly hit its first obstacle when our expected contact failed to meet us at the airport. Stranded in a foreign country where we couldn't speak the language, we were rescued by a Russian couple from our flight who offered us floor space in their hotel room. The next morning, maintaining our routine despite everything, my father took me to practice at a hotel tennis court. My skills drew attention from guests, including a Polish couple spoke Russian and offered to drive us to Rick Mackey's Academy, the training ground of the Williams sisters. At Mackey's, we faced our first bitter taste of American business reality. Despite an instructor's positive assessment of my skills, they demanded $1,000 up front, more than all the money we had. My father, offended by their reception and unwilling to part with our entire savings, refused their offer of temporary accommodation. The Polish couple, bewildered by his stubbornness but still helpful, bought us bus tickets to Bradenton, home of Nick Bollettieri's famous tennis academy. "Why would you say no to them?" the Polish woman asked my father. "They offered you a place to stay." "Because they don't believe," my father replied simply. "If they believed in Maria, they wouldn't ask for money first." This unwavering faith, sometimes appearing as stubborn pride, would become a defining characteristic of our journey. My father's willingness to walk away from apparent opportunities because they didn't align with his vision of my potential shaped every decision we made. We arrived in Bradenton at night and were shuttled to a Holiday Inn Express. The academy was closed until morning. That night in the hotel, my father triple-locked the door and slept with our money under his pillow, explaining that any robber would have to wake him, and that will be his last mistake. The next morning, we nearly lost everything when he forgot the money under the pillow, but raced back just in time to recover it before the maid took it. Life at Bollettieri's Academy became our new reality. We settled in a small apartment arranged by a Russian translator, paying $250 monthly to a middle-aged Russian woman whose attitude toward me swung between affection and hostility. The apartment was cramped and dark, with my father and I sharing a fold-out couch that sagged in the middle. Despite these hardships, I never felt insecure. I knew my father was fighting for me day and night. My days began before sunrise, with my father waking at 5 a.m. without an alarm. After breakfast, discussing the day's goals, he'd walk me to the academy gates. By 6:30 a.m., I'd be hitting balls, then joining group drills. Nick Bollettieri's philosophy kept us constantly moving, if not hitting balls, then retrieving them or shuffling our feet while waiting in line. I quickly noticed that most girls there were privileged but lacked real talent. They had neither coordination nor focus. Early on, I made a crucial decision. No one would ever be able to tell from my expression whether I'd won or lost. This emotional discipline became my trademark, setting me apart from competitors who wore their hearts on their sleeves. What drives a young girl to embrace such emotional control? Perhaps it was survival instinct in an environment where I was always the outsider, the Russian immigrant with no money among wealthy Americans. Or perhaps it was simply my nature, recognizing that vulnerability could be exploited on the court. Whatever the source, this stoic approach would become both my strength and, in the eyes of some fans, my weakness throughout my career. While I trained at the academy with lessons and meals covered, my father struggled to survive as immigrants in Bradenton. He took any job that paid cash, construction, yard work, odd jobs, while managing my career and teaching himself tennis through strategy books. He became Mr. Mom, handling everything from waking me before dawn to preparing meals and cutting my hair. For years, it was just the two of us sharing the same creaky fold-out bed and the same dreams. Despite my mother's absence, she remained connected through weekly phone calls and letters, insisting I maintain my Russian heritage. These early years toughened me. I developed the persona that would define my career. No emotion, no fear, like ice. I didn't befriend other players because it would make me softer when I needed to beat them. My intimidating presence became my edge, scaring other girls before we even stepped on court. Our situation at Bollettieri's didn't last long. We were forced to leave because I was too young, yet beating older girls, causing unhappiness among full fee-paying parents. We moved to El Conquistador, where coach Sekou Bangora took me on scholarship only after seeing me win a tournament. In exchange, my father had to work for him, essentially indentured servitude. Sekou even held my father's travel documents, controlling our movements. At El Conquistador, my father endured daily humiliation, doing busy work and taking insults while I trained. I appreciated the low-key atmosphere and having my father nearby, but hated that it felt second-rate compared to Bollettieri's. Sekou used me to promote his academy while I worked relentlessly. Despite these challenges, my game improved significantly, especially my powerful serve with its unique whip motion. During this period, I faced a major physical disadvantage, my height. I'd often compete against opponents a foot taller, making it difficult to generate power. When others might have quit, I persisted. Every night, I'd hang from the closet rod trying to stretch myself taller. Eventually, I reached 6'2", something my father attributes to determination rather than genetics. Have you ever wanted something so badly that you'd endure almost anything to achieve it? This was our daily reality, sacrificing comfort, dignity, and normalcy in pursuit of excellence. The tennis court became my sanctuary, the one place where social status and background didn't matter, only skill and will determined outcomes. Sekou paraded me around tournaments as his academy's advertisement. I played constantly, weekdays at the academy, weekends at tournaments, traveling across Florida in his dirty white van. By my 9th birthday, I was among America's best under-12 players, which put me back on Bulatieri's radar as I kept beating his best players. Our situation deteriorated when Sekou fired my father, claiming his presence was disruptive, while actually wanting to control me completely. Sekou presented a predatory contract for my future earnings, but we refused to sign despite our desperate circumstances. Bob Kane, a friend from the tournament circuit, rescued us, letting us stay at his Venice home for nearly a year while I continued training with my father. These experiences shaped my competitive mindset in ways formal training never could. I learned that talent alone wasn't enough. Persistence, strategic thinking, and mental toughness were equally important. I developed an ability to focus entirely on the present moment, blocking out distractions that would derail other players. Most importantly, I learned that setbacks were temporary, but giving up was permanent. My breakthrough came when I caught Betsy Nagelson's attention at a tournament. Married to Mark McCormick, founder of IMG, she called her husband saying, "There's a girl here in Florida, a tiny little Russian girl. You've got to send someone down to see her. She's going to be a star." McCormick dispatched Gavin Forbes, IMG's tennis talent scout. Gavin arranged an audition at Bulatieri's Academy, where I impressed him immediately. "You were always hitting the same ball, flat and hard," he recalled. "I watched you play for 30 to 40 minutes and was blown away by your understanding of the game, using the court like a chessboard." When asked about my goals, I looked him directly in the eye and said, "I want to be the best tennis player in the world." IMG sent Max Eisenbed to work with me. He would become one of the most important people in my life. Word spread that IMG wanted to sign me, and suddenly, agents worldwide were contacting my father. After considering multiple offers, we signed with IMG. They provided around $100,000 annually for coaching, equipment, travel, and living expenses. Nike executives came to see me play, and at 11, I signed my first Nike contract for $50,000 a year plus bonuses. This financial stability changed everything. For the first time, I understood tennis wasn't just a sport or passion, it was a business that could provide stability for my family. My father stopped landscaping work. His life became solely focused on tennis. We rented a 2-bedroom apartment large enough for my soon-to-return mother. I continued living at Bulatieri's Academy, which felt like a tennis prison with its institutional layout, strict schedules, and regimented life. My grueling daily routine began at 5:30 a.m. with early morning practice, followed by clinics, drills, more practice, fitness training, and minimal time for schoolwork before a 9 p.m. bedtime. Interestingly, Bulatieri's didn't focus on technical aspects of my game. When questioned, Nick explained, "If it ain't broke, you already had that thing, that desire, that makes good players champions. We did not want to do anything to screw that up. It's like a fire. If that fire is already going, your task is to get out of the way and let it burn." Everything improved when my mother finally joined us in Florida after 2 years apart. She immediately restored normalcy to my life, fixing my hair, improving my education with Russian literature, and creating a warm home environment. Meanwhile, my father became even more obsessed with my tennis development, eventually deciding we needed to visit Robert Lansdorp in Los Angeles, declaring him the man who's going to make you the number one player in the world. think about the pressure this places on a child to have adults constantly discussing your potential, making business deals based on your future performance, and structuring their lives around your development. How many 11-year-olds have contracts with major corporations? How many have adults betting their careers on their success? This unusual childhood created both tremendous opportunity and tremendous responsibility, a weight I carried from an early age. Robert Lansdorp noticed something unusual about me. I had natural ability with my left hand. When my father later suggested I switch to playing left-handed, claiming Yodkin messed it all up, I resisted, but eventually agreed to try. For several months, I experimented with playing left-handed, first as a pure lefty, then with two-handed strokes on both sides like Monica Seles. While Lansdorp was impressed, Nick Bellettieri and others at the academy were frustrated by this radical change. My body felt completely disoriented. North became south, back became front. After 3 or 4 months, Nick confronted us, telling me I needed to make a choice, lefty or righty, and that the decision was mine alone. I was devastated, crying when I got home. After days of deliberation, I chose to remain right-handed, unwilling to lose years of development at age 12. Though I stayed right-handed, this experiment strengthened my backhand significantly. My father remembers the decision differently, claiming he made the choice after seeing a horoscope that read, "The number one women's tennis player in the world will have the initials MS and she will be right-handed." At 14, I began playing in major tournaments worldwide, approaching the professional tour. But my body betrayed me as I suddenly grew 8 inches, eventually reaching 6'2". This growth spurt left me gangly, uncoordinated, and in pain as my bones ached from rapid growth. The timing couldn't have been worse. Through IMG's wildcards, I was competing in professional tournaments but couldn't control my new body. I suffered my first real losing streak, losing everywhere on every surface. I remember crying in stadium hallways and seeing pity in the eyes of opponents who had once feared me. This difficult period taught me more than winning ever could. I never completely lost confidence. I still believed I would win every match I entered. Eventually, my brain began to understand my body, though the change came subtly during another loss. After losing in the final of a challenger tournament in Pittsburgh at age 15, my father decided my serve needed transformation. "You are growing into a powerful woman, and you must serve like one," he insisted. We worked with Coach Peter McGraw at Bellettieri's, refining my serve to take advantage of my height, strength, and unusual shoulder flexibility that allowed me to reach so far back that my knuckles occasionally brushed my spine, creating a powerful slingshot effect. My new serve became my defining weapon. It transformed a mediocre shot into something devastating that gave me free points and let me dictate play. At 15, I began winning consistently, propelled into what would become some of the best years of my career, though I would eventually pay a price for the tremendous pressure it put on my shoulder. Have you ever experienced a growth period where your body seemed to belong to someone else? Imagine that happening while competing at the highest levels of international sport. The mental resilience required to push through such physical changes speaks to the psychological strength that would define my career, the ability to adapt and overcome when circumstances seemed stacked against me. My professional tennis career began in spring 2001 at 14. I started with small tournaments before reaching junior nationals and grand slams. At 13, I'd already made the Junior Italian Open final against a 17-year-old. My WTA debut came at the 2002 Pacific Life Open, where I beat Bree Ripner before facing Monica Seles. Though I lost 6-0-6-2, the match showed I could compete with the best while highlighting how far I had to go. The 2002 Australian Open Juniors marked my first major breakthrough. Something had shifted inside me, and I reached the final at 14 years and 9 months, the youngest finalist ever. That same year at Wimbledon, which my father called the soul of tennis, I reached the junior final, losing to Vera Dushevina. At the Wimbledon ball, watching Serena Williams' grand entrance, I remained seated, silently vowing to defeat her. Turning 16 in April 2003 allowed me to play the Pro Tour full-time. After early struggles at the Australian and French Opens, Wimbledon 2003 became my turning point. The grass courts suited my game perfectly. With a wildcard entry, I defeated Ashley Harklerode, Elena Bovina, and stunned the tennis world by beating world number 4, Jelena Dokic. The following year, I faced Serena Williams in the 2004 Wimbledon final. Despite her intimidating presence, I noticed fear in her eyes by the fourth game, the realization of potentially losing to a 17-year-old. I won the first set 6-1. Though Serena led 4-2 in the second set, I fought back to level at 4-4, broke her serve, and won match point with a decisive forehand. That moment of victory, dropping to my knees, climbing into the stands to embrace my father, contained all our struggles and dreams. At 17, I'd achieved tennis's highest honor. The question now was how to prove this wasn't just a teenage fairy tale, but the start of a champion's career. Fame arrived suddenly after Wimbledon. The phone rang constantly with offers, but it was the Motorola deal that truly launched my commercial career. The ad concept came directly from the Wimbledon final, me trying to call my mom with my father's phone, but getting no signal. Motorola contacted IMG the day after my win, and soon I was shooting an ad with their unreleased Razr phone. The Motorola partnership became a blueprint for my endorsement career. Max's strategy was choosing quality over quantity. We declined larger offers from competing phone companies to maintain a premium image. This approach worked brilliantly, as blue-chip brands like Tag Heuer, Land Rover, and Nike soon followed. Fame brought unexpected complications. Suddenly, reporters cared more about my life off court than on it. Beach photos in a swimsuit would appear online overnight, and ridiculous dating rumors circulated daily. The attention was irritating for a 17-year-old. The success also created tension with other players who saw endorsements as a zero-sum game. If I got deals, they didn't. Elena Dementieva's mother complained to my Russian masseur that Elena can't get any deals in Japan because Maria has taken them all. The jealousy became something I had to manage alongside my tennis career. Money changed everything. Shopping at TJ Maxx in Bradenton after Wimbledon, I suddenly realized I can buy whatever I want, fulfilling a dream I'd had in that same store years earlier. We bought our first home in Longboat Key, Florida, followed by a house in LA. My days of motor courts and shared dorm rooms were over. Yet beneath these changes, my fundamental routine remained unchanged. Tennis, practice, run, hit, play, stretch, sleep. What did change was how others treated me. Tournament organizers provided drivers and better practice courts. The atmosphere turned chilly as jealous competitors targeted me. Everyone studied my game, probing for weaknesses. Every match became significant, if not for me, then for my opponent desperate to take down a Wimbledon champion. This presented my first major career challenge, proving I wasn't a one-hit wonder. The history books are filled with players who won a single Grand Slam but never figured out how to adjust after everyone else adjusted to them. Only by winning again could I prove my first Grand Slam wasn't a fluke. I started the 2005 season determined to validate my position. After a heartbreaking semifinal loss to Serena Williams at the Australian Open, where I held 3 match points, I entered one of my most consistent stretches, 2005 and 2006, when I played my best tennis. I finally understood my game. My strengths, hitting hard, flat, and deep, my backhand down the line, my serve, my stamina and will, and my weaknesses, speed, movement to the net. In summer 2005, I achieved my father's dream, becoming world number 1. Though I'd been focused on Grand Slams rather than rankings, I was surprised how much it meant to me. Still, I needed that second Grand Slam to prove I deserved the top spot. That validation came at the 2006 US Open, where I defeated top seed Amélie Mauresmo in the semifinals before facing Justine Henin in the final. Wearing the black Audrey Hepburn dress from my Nike commercial, I controlled the match from start to finish, winning in straight sets. When I raised the silver trophy with the lid falling off, I had proven myself, that impossible second Grand Slam, won in New York with everyone watching. Have you ever noticed how success often brings as many challenges as failures? The pressure to maintain excellence, the jealousy of peers, the constant scrutiny, these are the hidden costs of achieving your dreams. Learning to navigate these waters became as important as my backhand or serve.
2008 began with the loss of Robert Lansdorp, my beloved but difficult coach, after a falling out with my father. Though I won my third Grand Slam at the Australian Open, playing some of my cleanest tennis ever, a persistent shoulder pain soon developed that would change everything. Despite seeing multiple doctors who diagnosed tendonitis, then bursitis, and prescribed rest, ice, anti-inflammatories, and even cortisone shots, the pain remained. The diagnosis finally came from Dr. David Allcheck in New York. My shoulder tendon was torn. I needed surgery, and he warned me no tennis player had returned to the top after such an operation. At 21, facing the potential end of my career, I refused to accept this fate. The surgery in October 2008 was terrifying. My rehab began in Arizona with excruciating pain, even with half-pound weights. By Christmas, I was hitting balls again, but everything felt wrong. My strength, flexibility, and range of motion were gone. I couldn't generate power on my serve anymore. My ranking plummeted during my absence. I missed defending my Australian Open title and returned to competition in March 2009. My French Open comeback ended with a humiliating quarterfinal loss. At Wimbledon, my magical place, I suffered a second-round defeat to unranked Gisela Dolko. The press wrote obituaries for my career at 22, with headlines declaring, "It's all over for Sharapova." In the aftermath of these losses, I had few people to turn to for comfort. Unlike most professionals who can confide in work colleagues, I maintained distance from other tennis players. This wasn't personal, it was strategic. I believe friendship with opponents creates a competitive disadvantage. When you like someone, it's harder to destroy them on court. After working with Michael Joyce since 2005, our relationship had become too brotherly, lacking spark. We hired Thomas Hoogstedt as a second coach, but he quickly dominated Joyce, forcing us to make the painful decision to let Michael go. My shoulder would never be like it was at 17, but I'd found a new way to play, relying less on serve and more on returns. I needed another Grand Slam victory to prove I'd truly come back from surgery. I came close at the 2012 Australian Open, reaching the final, but losing disappointingly to Victoria Azarenka. At the 2012 French Open, I entered as a strong favorite, having won 12 clay matches coming in. After battling through tough matches, I faced Sara Errani in the final. Everything clicked perfectly that day. I won in straight sets, completing a career Grand Slam, only the 10th woman ever to do so. 8 years after winning Wimbledon at 17, I'd come full circle, appreciating this victory with new eyes. I'd lost everything and miraculously gotten it all back. When people ask if I'm Russian or American, the answer isn't simple. I grew up in Florida, shaped by American movies and television. My humor is more Seinfeld than Gogol. Yet I've never stopped feeling Russian in my soul. This is why receiving a text from the Russian Tennis Federation asking if I'd carry the flag for Russia at the 2012 London Olympics meant so much. As the first woman ever given this honor by Russia, I walked in front of our team in a burgundy coat and straw hat, fulfilling a childhood dream. What defines true resilience? Is it the ability to withstand pain or the capacity to reinvent yourself when your original path is blocked? My comeback from shoulder surgery taught me that adaptation is sometimes more important than raw determination. Knowing when to change your approach rather than simply trying harder along the same path. By winter 2015, I was contemplating my future beyond tennis when I received an unusual email from the ITF. My urine sample from Australia had tested positive for Maldonium, which I knew as Maldronate, an over-the-counter supplement I'd been taking for 10 years on my doctor's recommendation for heart issues. For 7 years, I had written confirmation from a WADA-accredited lab that all my supplements, including Maldronate, were permissible. But WADA had banned meldonium as of January 2016, burying this change in a catalog of banned substances accessible through multiple email links, links I never followed. This was my mistake, but the ITF's poor notification was theirs. Feeling blindsided, I called a press conference to explain the situation transparently. Despite my honesty, the media attacked me, calling me a cheater and liar. Nike suspended me, which devastated me after being with them since age 11. That night, I sobbed hysterically in my bedroom while my mother held my hand. The next morning became my hinge moment, either stay in bed or get up. I dragged myself to a spinning class, crying through the entire session, but I knew I'd survive. While preparing for my hearing, I trained intensely, despite my provisional ban. The ITF hearing was a sham. A panel selected by the ITF itself would decide my case. My lawyer warned me not to expect justice in this round. We needed to lose here to reach the impartial court of arbitration for sport. When the verdict came, a 2-year suspension, I was devastated, though the panel acknowledged I hadn't intended to violate rules. While awaiting appeal, I kept training, enrolled in Harvard Business School, and even shadowed NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, small doses of happiness that sustained me. Finally, on October 4, 2016, the CAS reduced my ban to 15 months, explicitly stating I was not an intentional doper and clearing my name. The experience taught me that while there's no perfect justice, you can only work hard, do your best, and tell the truth. Rather than thinking about retirement, I now focus only on playing, as long as I can, as hard as I can. Throughout my journey, from that first racket in Sochi to Grand Slam championships to fighting for my reputation, one thing has remained constant: the determination that defines me. It's what my father saw in that 4-year-old hitting against a wall for hours. It's what carried me through the lonely years in Florida when we had nothing. It's what helped me recover from shoulder surgery when doctors said I couldn't. And it's what sustained me through the darkest days of my suspension. Tennis gave me everything: a career, financial security, global recognition. But more importantly, it taught me who I am. The court doesn't lie. It reveals character, exposes weaknesses, and rewards strength. In those critical moments between points, when it's just you alone with your thoughts and the weight of expectation, you discover what you're truly made of. What would you fight for when everything you've built is threatened? How would you respond when your integrity is questioned? These aren't hypothetical questions for me. They designed the final chapters of my tennis story. And through it all, I discovered that the same quality that made me pick up that racket as a child in Sochi is what continues to drive me forward: the absolute refusal to stay down when life knocks you over. Looking back at my journey, I recognize how many people shaped my path. My mother, whose elegance and boldness gave me strength even when she was oceans away. My father, who guided me to be a champion without pressuring me to win specific matches. The coaches who saw potential in a skinny Russian girl with determination beyond her years. The rivals who pushed me to improve constantly. Tennis is often described as the loneliest sport. Just you on the court with no teammates, no timeouts, nowhere to hide. Yet paradoxically, no tennis player succeeds alone. We are the product of countless sacrifices, investments, and beliefs from others. My father's unwavering conviction that I could be number one. My mother's insistence that I remain connected to my Russian roots. Max Eisenbud's creative approach to building my brand beyond the court. Each played an essential role in my development. What remains after the trophies are won and the spotlight dims? For me, it's the lessons learned through struggle rather than success. The understanding that determination matters more than talent. The knowledge that adaptation is as important as persistence. The realization that your reputation, built over decades, can be threatened in an instant and must be defended with the same vigor as any championship point. Tennis gave me a platform, but it also gave me perspective. From the little girl in Sochi with a cut-down racket, to the Wimbledon champion, to the athlete fighting to clear her name, each version of Maria taught me something valuable about myself and the world. The journey wasn't always beautiful, It was often painful, lonely, and unfair, but it was authentically mine. Perhaps that's the ultimate measure of a life well lived, not the victories or defeats, but the ownership of your path, the willingness to make difficult choices and accept their consequences, the courage to stand alone when necessary, the resilience to get up that 11th time when you've been knocked down 10. As I look toward whatever comes next, I carry these lessons with me, along with the pearl bracelet my mother gave me and the memories of that tiny apartment on Cherry Street where it all began. The courts may change, the opponents may differ, but the determination remains the same. Knock me down 10 times, I get up the 11th.